A hurried wedding ceremony took place deep underground, in the cramped and musty concrete rooms of the Führerbunker. Eva Braun wore a black dress. Goebbels was the best man. His last stand was to shoot his dog Blondie, see to it that Eva died, and then bite down on a cyanide capsule, shooting himself in the head, just in case. A pathetic end for the man who had nearly turned the whole world to iron and ash. Hours later, the Soviets rolled into town, just in time to find smoldering corpses in a makeshift pyre. Thus ended Adolf Hitler of the Third Reich. Maybe it says something about the people who've been listening to Blind History. I hope not. But the most requested person is someone who we thought we'd deal with in the second last episode of season 6 of Blind History. What does this say about our audience, and that they wanted Adolf Hitler, and he's been the most requested person since we started doing Blind History?
Well, I mean, we hope they just like a little bit of blood, but not necessarily agree with with these principles.
Outside of Jesus Christ and of Napoleon, Hitler is probably the most written about, and he may eclipse Napoleon, certainly. I don't know if he'll eclipse Jesus. In terms of the number of publications that have been written about him, you can go into any bookstore, you could turn on the History Channel, you could pretty much go onto the internet on any day of the week, and you can even listen to speeches from modern-day politicians who cite and quote and slander each other with the name of Hitler every other day. So his name is larger than his life, and his life was not insignificant. But this is probably, when people think of evil human beings, the first name that comes to mind, which is why he's so often called out as an example of the very worst kind of human.
Yeah, there's no doubt. But some people said if he died in 1938, Hitler and Germany, for that matter, was at the heart of its power and strength, he might have gone down in history as one of the great statesmen, you know, of all time.
Absolutely. There's so many stories about Hitler, and we're going to try and cover a few of those and give you some anecdotal stuff you might not already know. The chronology is easy to find. He was born in Austria, the son of Alois, and his mother, who he loved, Clara, he loved her to pieces. He was raised as a bit of a mommy's boy. I mean, she'd lost some other children, and he lost his brother, Edmund, at I think age 11. And that affected him quite badly. Apparently, he slept at the grave most nights because their house was right across the road from the cemetery. It seems to have affected him very badly. Didn't have a relationship with his father at all. His father used to beat him. And life in the Hitler household, which, by the way, Hitler wasn't even the surname. Hitler was a name that was written down wrong. You know, so many South Africans during the apartheid era, especially the Indian or black, the Home Affairs people just write down whatever it sounded like. And, you know, that was then the name. That's why you get different spellings of so many Indian and black surnames in South Africa. Fact is that Hitler's actual surname wasn't Hitler. And Hitler means living in a hut, which isn't a grand thing to be called. But for some reason, they kept it anyway. His mother died when he was 18. But the interesting thing about Hitler is up to the age of 18, he was a nothing. He hung around at home. He didn't look for a job. He was lazy. He didn't get good school marks. He was an unexceptional person in every possible way. Nothing fancy in his early life.
His dad was actually a state customs officer. So I think we've all met customs officials, and they're very strict disciplinarians. And he had as much flexibility as a pretzel. He used to beat him, like you said. And he actually loathed his dad, but there's a lot of propaganda, especially in the later years, of the relationship between him and his dad, that you're not sure to what level or how bad the relationship was. But he painted this aura constantly through his life, smoke and mirrors. So it's difficult to see. But yes, lazy. He didn't get past secondary school. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be an artist, if you can imagine that. He wasn't that bad, but he failed to get into the Academy of Arts in Vienna on two occasions.
Yeah, failed the exams and they wouldn't let him back in.
Correct, yes. And I think there he was lonely, isolated. And at that stage, he stated in Mein Kampf and in other areas that he was poor and he slept on park benches. Yeah. But in actual fact, his father, on passing away, there was support for him over quite a long period of time. He could draw off money.
But he did blow a whole lot of the money going to the opera, dressing up. He lived beyond his means after both his parents had died, even if he had inherited the money. I suppose one of the reasons that his art never really took off is his mother kept telling him how good he was. And you know how many people's mothers tell them that they're great and then they end up not being so great. Yeah. And he thought he was fantastic. What she did give him was an outsized sense of confidence. Like, according to his mother, he was the greatest person that ever lived and could do anything.
Yeah, I didn't pick that up, though, in his life.
Oh, you didn't think he had confidence shouting at everyone in Germany for thousands of years. The short story is that after messing around and really wasting much of his time, not studying anything, not having a plan, not having a career, painting a little bit just to make ends meet, he decided to enlist for World War I.
He moved to Munich and they had to come and find him because there was conscription. And then when they did find him, physically, he didn't make it into the army. And then because he was in Munich, he asked to actually join the Bavarian army. Effectively, he did. He was in the front line, but he was a runner, as they called it. So he would take messages backwards and forwards. And he did actually get injured. He got gassed. And I think an important point is when you look at some of the images when he was younger, he had a big mustache, which was the style of the day. And because of the gas warfare that they put into World War One, they had to cut the mustaches and put that toothbrush mustache that he's so well known for. And that was basically to fit the mask on their faces initially.
Yeah, because that's become like a trademark of kind of Hitler. And I don't think it's a very popular kind of mustache these days.
I don't think so.
Not too many people wandering around with that now. But the interesting thing too about that World War One situation is he did go to Passchendaele. He did have firsthand experience of what the battlefront looked like. And I mean, as we've discussed in previous episodes of Blind History, that must have been the most absolutely horrific thing to have witnessed. And he obviously was up against the British then, and he had a very ugly relationship with them going into the future as well from that point on. Ultimately, we know what happened. Kaiser Wilhelm II made some terrible decisions along with the high command, and they lost the war. And this was a huge relief to much of Europe, but to Germany, it meant crippling punishment. It meant the Treaty of Versailles. It meant humiliation, and it meant huge indebtedness. And of course, Weimar Germany was a very tough place, but quite apart from how tough it was, there was also extraordinary inflation, probably the highest inflation ever recorded in history. You know, we often think of Zimbabwe just a few years ago, where you needed essentially a wheelbarrow full of cash just to buy milk. This was the case in Weimar Germany. It was a horrible place to live. People were desperate. They didn't have jobs. They didn't have money. They had nothing to look forward to.
I think they said $1 was equal to a trillion marks, German marks. And it would vacillate, similar to what Zimbabwe had. There was a story of an artist that got onto a tram, and he was stopped halfway because his ticket was no longer valid because he hadn't paid enough. So there was 25% unemployment, which if you think about in Germany, that hadn't happened before or after for that matter. So it was a very, very dark place. And I think that this was the catalyst or the fertilizer or whatever you want to call it, the fertile ground that allowed a nut job like Hitler to be able to gain such popularity and reach the heights that he did.
We have to remember the German people were desperate. And everybody thinks that if I were there in Germany in 1933, I would never have fallen for this stuff. But there was absolutely nothing going on. And people had all the reasons in the world to feel absolutely dreadful. Things were tougher than they'd ever been. And along came this guy who said, by the way, it's not your fault. I can fix this. Germany deserves to be great. Let's blame these people. And people fell in love with that messaging. Yeah. Hitler blamed the loss of World War One on the Jews. Now, his relationship with the Jews is very complicated because when he was selling paintings, most of the people who bought his paintings in Vienna were Jews. He had a surgeon later in life who he rewarded by sending him outside of Austria once they started the anti-Semitic attacks.
He got the Iron Cross.
Yes, in World War One.
And it was presented to him by a Jewish officer, which is also very ironic.
Yes. He may even have been Jewish himself. They've done DNA tests on close living relatives and of people who they know were related to Hitler and discovered not only did he have Jewish ancestry, but also African ancestry, which is interesting. So he was far from being this Aryan that he claimed himself to be. He wrote this book called Mein Kampf. Now, what I didn't realize is that Hitler made millions in dollars. Mm. He made millions for the sales of Mein Kampf. I mean, he was making something in excess of about $14 million a year in today's money with the sale of that book. It was a runaway success. The book, obviously, which you can read again in Germany, for a long time it was banned, is all about him in the war, him going to jail for the putsch in Munich, his joining of the Nazi party. He was actually member number 555 of the Nazi party when he joined it in Munich. But he was actually a spy at that stage and maybe was persuaded by being in the room with so many of these people. He also learnt as a spy for the old Bavarian government. He learnt how to make speeches and how to pick out communists and, you know, people who were against the state. And many people say that that was the most important part of his education, because he learned there how to use oratory to persuade people. And this would eventually set him on a career in politics.
He was massively persuasive. It's incredible, yes. You know, what he actually did. And I think he felt that the National Socialist Deutsche Arbeitsparty, the Nazi party, that their current leader was a bit soft. And so he came in and ultimately took over already in the 1919 when he joined. In 1920, I think he was already in charge.
He rose to prominence very quickly. The Nazi party, especially after 1929, was on the ascendant, so much so that Paul von Hindenburg, who was the president, had to appoint Hitler chancellor at that stage. And Hitler went ahead and started making some huge reforms almost instantly. And very happily and luckily, in inverted commas, for the Nazis, the Reichstag caught fire. Now, whether or not that fire was set by them, in retrospect, it looks like they were the only beneficiaries from what happened afterwards. It gave Hitler the opportunity to create a whole slew of laws, first of all, to outlaw and destroy the communists, but also to make himself essentially dictator, just like Julius Caesar had done in Rome. You know, he was dictator for life. In the Kroll Opera House, where Parliament had moved since the Reichstag had been burned, he was given the most power that Germany had ever given to one man since the Kaiser, I think, and went ahead and started with his policies of Lebensraum and his policies of rearming Germany and his policies of essentially putting them back in a position that would have invalidated the Treaty of Versailles. And most of Europe, which was war-weary, just stood by and watched.
Yeah, they did watch. But interestingly enough, compared to the other dictators we've covered in Blind History, he had north of 90% support, actually, which was phenomenal. He went from 2.6% of the share of the votes in 1928. And incredibly, 2 years later, he was up to 18% nationally. And he really looked at it for a national Germany. So he spoke the right language in the beginning. And the industrialists and the business guys and the financiers were all got onto his side because of his oratory skills.
But also their alternative was the communists, and yeah, they knew that that would mean they'd end up poor.
Yeah, very 100%, very much. But also his personal life then became more relaxed. You know, I think that the army gave him a second chance. He got a bit of income, and then his meteoric rise. And after he had written the book Mein Kampf and the income from that, he became more relaxed, and he bought that incredible palatial villa in the Bavarian Alps.
Berchtesgaden.
Yeah, Berchtesgaden, yeah. Where he spent a lot of time because he was still reclusive in a lot of ways.
Well, he's supposed to have had an affair with his niece, although people say that a lot of that might be an exaggeration by people who have subsequently liked to tell stories about Hitler. But he certainly had started in 1929 a relationship with a woman called Eva Braun, who was much younger than him, and who was like a love-struck teenager. In fact, she tried to commit suicide twice just to get his attention when he wasn't paying her the requisite amount of attention during their relationship. In fact, she was so jealous of Hitler's attention that she's supposed to have kicked his dog Blondie when Hitler wasn't looking because he paid more attention to the dog.
Oh, he did. He actually did love animals for that matter, but she was a very simple young woman with maybe not too many intellectual gifts, I don't think.
That's a kind way to put it. Of course, Hitler did eventually professed that he was in love with her. She became a bit of an item, especially in Berchtesgaden, you know, sitting at his right-hand side and looking after the guests and being put in charge of hospitality. And eventually she would die with him and they would be married. But the love of his life was probably his mother and then Eva Braun.
Yeah, I think Blondie came in between Eva and and his mom.
Yeah, I mean, you know, modern historian and biographer Ian Kershaw says that Hitler was the embodiment of modern political evil. But as is the case with anyone, when you bother to do a little more research, you find there are things about their personality that you think, oh, well, that's not so bad. I mean, you know, certainly Hitler, as you rightly pointed out, put Germany in the pound seats after taking over as chancellor. And that was perhaps due to his sheer force of will, but also because it was coming off a very low base. So what you've got here is a very complex human being at a very complex time in history. We know what happened after that. War, you know, first it was the Saarland, then it was the Anschluss, then it was the Sudetenland, then it was Poland. And by that stage, the world couldn't believe what was going on. I mean, there were some very clever moves by Hitler, but others were obvious and blatant. Yeah. And they could have seen it coming, you know, Neville Chamberlain arriving back in London with the treaty that he'd signed saying, we have peace in our time. Only a few months later, Poland was invaded and Britain and the rest of the Allies had to declare war on Germany. You cannot scoff and you cannot say it is a small thing that he rolled his tanks into Paris and was being given a tour of Paris as its conqueror in June of 1941. With barely any resistance. It took them weeks to conquer France, which everyone thought was the most powerful force in Europe.
But if you look at Germany and you look at what we've done in blind history, and we look at Charlemagne and what he managed to achieve, we looked at Julius Caesar with Gaul and then Hadrian for that matter and Augustus and what they achieved. Then you look at Europe under Nazi Germany. I mean, they had Sweden, they had Norway, they had Netherlands, they had France, you know, they had Spain and Portugal.
Poland. They very nearly had Russia. Maybe that's where he fell down. Yeah. And, you know, there are people who say that his life became very different post 1942, 43. You know, he tried to invade Britain. Goering said to him, don't worry, don't worry, we've got this. My Luftwaffe will take care of this. Of course, they didn't. And then one RAF bomb went awry and hit some civilians in Berlin when they were going for military targets. And Hitler said to Goering, fine, you can't do this. I'm taking over. We're going after London. The difficulty there is that if they'd stuck to Goering's plan and kept bombing military bases and so on, the RAF would never have had a chance to actually launch counterattacks or to defend themselves in the Battle of Britain. So in some ways, again, Hitler himself was responsible for his own demise. Same thing happened in Russia. They went in the winter, didn't listen to Napoleon's lesson of a couple of years before, and supply lines were bad. Petrol turned into jelly because they weren't using diesel in their tanks. And it was a disaster. It was an absolute mess. Operation Barbarossa is what they called it.
That was the beginning of the end. But the big turn was, and we mentioned it actually in this season with Himmler, they changed their policy from exiling the Jewish nation and the Bolsheviks, Slavs, and the homosexuals, they changed it to extermination. And that was the crux of the evil that took place.
If you ask most people, they wouldn't know any of the things we've brought up in blind history so far, bar one or two, but they will absolutely know about the genocide of the Jewish people and the genocide of so many others. And the fact that the war itself cost the lives of millions and millions of people. And I don't think the world has completely recovered from that in some ways. And did Hitler go mad? Was he a perfect example of absolute power corrupting absolutely? Or did he actually have a mental health condition? Or was he being fed methamphetamines by his doctor? We know for a fact that he was being treated with those. All these uppers and all these downers, you know, he'd take sleeping tablets and then pass out for a day and a half. This is not a healthy way for someone who's running a country to behave. And many people say that towards the end of his life, he was a drug addict. There was the very famous plot against him, which Rommel led, and which made him even more paranoid. You know, the Stauffenberg bomb plot.
Yes.
And towards the end, Hitler trusted nobody. And he was a paranoid lunatic. And he thought that Germany was his in every way, shape, and form to command. He also thought that there was always a way out. Even to the bitter end, he believed that the troops in Berlin would save him.
It just also showed you the mindset of the Germans, especially the German aristocracy. Von Stauffenberg was one of them. And I mean, this was an officer and a gentleman. I mean, he's an extremely good-looking man. And he was really a soldier, and there were a lot of them. And so all of those assassination attempts were all from within Germany, and it was a lot.
Yes. I mean, there were certainly people who had realized that Hitler was out of control at some point. There must have been people who found out about what he was doing to the Jews, for example, and must have thought, we can't be part of this.
100%.
There were people. And, you know, often the German nation has taken responsibility. They continue to pay not only money, but also to make sure that within Germany, Nazism is discouraged in any way, shape, and form. In other parts of the world, neo-Nazis have turned up, but in Germany, not. And we cannot see the German people as being completely responsible. There were lots of people who were very much against Hitler, specifically after they started seeing the signs that this guy was out of control and was likely to cause the death of not only millions of foreigners, but even their own families, their own nation. And ultimately, Germany was leveled to the ground at the end of World War II just because of this man's extraordinary ambition and megalomania.
He was 100% responsible for World War II and for the extermination.
6 million Jews and many millions more. But ultimately, the story is that he committed suicide in the bunker, the Führerbunker in Berlin, and that he advised in his will, just after he'd married Eva Braun, where Goebbels was his best man, that he would like to be burnt so that they could find no trace of him to obviously do terrible things to. And, you know, the historians have compared many sources, and they say that the body was half burnt. The Soviets are supposed to have got a piece of his skull, and subsequently dental records have been pulled, and they've pretty much authenticated that those teeth must come from Hitler. So he is dead, even though there are rumors and conspiracy theories that he fled to South America in a U-boat. Even an amazing story that the Nazis built a base on the dark side of the moon. I mean, you know, conspiracy theories abound about Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. The interesting thing about Hitler, too, is that there's lots of photographic and video evidence of what kind of things the man said, did, what he looked like. And while for so many of the people we've studied in blind history, there isn't necessarily that much documentary evidence, this didn't happen so long ago. There are still people alive, and there are still interviews that can be had with people who worked in his household, people who met him, people who knew him. And that is a frightening thing about history, is that you're living in it and you don't know it. And then suddenly things have turned for the worse and all of Europe is in ashes. And it's because of this one man who, you know, you might have met at a rally once, or whose bathroom you cleaned as a hotel housekeeper. It's an incredible thing to hear these stories coming out now. And as I said, there are so many fascinating books about Hitler. I mean, I've got a few of them. I'm not as much of a Hitler maniac as so many other people, because it bothers us that someone could rise to prominence and do such hideous, evil things and seem so normal at some point. I mean, the ongoing question is, if you could go back in time and murder 5-year-old Adolf Hitler, would you, knowing what he would do? And it's something that many people wrestle with in philosophy.
You know, that also from my side, you know, my dad was born in 1937 in the heart of Germany, very close to Nuremberg. He was very, very young in the war. Ernst, his brother, received the Reichmark from Adolf Hitler. And my dad never spoke about it, actually. One thing, he just hated potatoes because that's all they ate in the war. You know, so during the war times, there was no food. And sometimes the army would set up radio camps inside their farmyard. So there was definitely an impact on my dad's life from that perspective. And, they're all very proud to be German, but just so, you know, ashamed of that period and what it stood for.
We have to have a bit of context here. We're going to finish the season with someone who's a very different historical character, and I'm looking forward to doing that. But you've got to look at the context of this. He Hitler showed the singular and incalculable power of personality in politics and history. He has to be among the most complicated people, but he simplifies history, because when you look at what happened there, it's very easy to see good from bad. I think that there are probably lots of people who would argue, including Hafner, the famous historian, that other than Alexander the Great, Hitler had a more significant impact than almost any other comparable historical figure. He caused such a range of worldwide changes in such a short space of time that there are still parts of the world that are reeling from the shock of this one man's life. And that is extraordinary.
Yeah.
It really is. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, there was a comedian that was probably one of the great comedians of all time, Mel Brooks. And he did a Hitler skit, and you know, I've remembered it for many, many years. And he was acting as Hitler. He said, "I want peace, 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 a piece of Austria, a piece of Czechoslovakia, a piece of Switzerland."
Mel Brooks is brilliant because he was also one of the first comedians to actually make like a funny movie about the Nazis.
Yes,
because he'd have them dancing, and he had Jews in space, which was a, you know, he was a really, really clever guy and continues to be, still alive.